Dinovism. I don't want to mention the names. But in today, from, Asia to Africa to Australia to America and Europe, in all these places, Islam is growing, and according to many statistics, it is the fastest growing religion. So is it through sword too? This is a very serious question. So I believe that, this is a wrong understanding about the spirit of Islam. And then I would like to repeat another point that I mentioned in the previous program. When we read the history of Islam, we see that, yes, some wars were conducted by the first 30 caliphs.
Yes.
But as soon as Imam Ali alayhi salam reaches caliphate, although he's the true successor of the Prophet, but people select him as the fourth caliph, he stops attacking any country.
Yes.
And all the wars at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam again are defensive, and they are between the Muslims. So yes, no one can ever claim that Imam Ali alayhi salam has attacked any country to spread the religion of Islam. And yes, again, for us as the Shia, it is very meaningful that no one has the right to attack another country for spreading the religion of Islam. After him, Imam Hassan alayhi salam was also in power for some month.
Yes.
He never did that too, and the rest of the Imams.
And just look at the slogans of Islam when it was spreading. One of the most important, which was brotherhood, Khawwa.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is Adala, equality, okay? So, for example, when attacking Iran, on that time it was ruled by the Sassanid, and Yazgird III was the ruler. Yazgird is the grandson of Khosrow Parviz, who tore apart the letter of Prophet Muhammad, son of Shahriyar, okay? So, on that time, you could see that inequality was over the land. Only the kings could study, only the kings could transact, and most of the people were under the control and supremacy of a kind of monarch lifestyle. So Islam, with the slogan of, we could say what?
Justice and
justice,
equality.
Equality and brotherhood, comes to the scene, and in most of the regions of Iran, led them to be Zoroastrian.
Mm-hmm.
This is important, okay?
Yeah.
It did not force them to convert into the religion of Islam, but only said them, you pay the Islamic tax and you stay on your own religion. That's why up until today in Iran, we have minorities of
exactly.
the people, Zoroastrians,
exactly.
who live on their own religion. That's right, okay? So it shows that it was not a kind of forceful attack. Although it was not a kind of Nabawi method
exactly.
of war, but it was not that much forceful too. The slogans work too. Okay, that's all right. Also, Islam was spread in other part in Europe, for example, Andalusia. You know, today's Spain. It was spread over there too. You know, still we could see Islamic architecture and all across the world. So it changed the whole system of thought. But what is important is that the tribal system of the Arabs at the beginning of Islam, in order to spread Islam, was very much ruled by the Roman empires, you know? And this was under the influence of the Jews, because the Jews imitated the Roman and Greek empire to spread Islam. What did they do to Jesus Christ through killing and massacre and this and that in the war system, you know? The war attacks and the war systems was imitated by the Roman empires. So Umayyads, especially, and Abbasids, imitated very much the Jewish system and the Christian system of attacking other lands, which was in contrast to, how can I say, Islamic, true Islamic, Muhammadan Islam. But still, we could say even today, Islam is the religion of peace. Islam is not the religion of attack. ISIS look of Islam is not at all confirmed by the religion of Islam. We can say the extremist look that some people have by suicide bombing or here and spreading the religion of Islam is not at all confirmed and accepted by Muslims, both Sunnis and Shias. And this peaceful talk has been the method of Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt. Thank you much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration.
Please.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, call of Islam page, and Allah, so God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. Li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
The story of Saudi Arabia. Part 2. Saudi Arabia these days has made headlines in many parts of the world, from its domestic politics and relations with the US to its ground and aerial attacks on Yemen. But one of these developments was very important and strange. Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was once the most trusted journalist of the royal family, went missing in a peculiar way. He entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, but never came out. After an hour, his fiancée, who was waiting outside, informed his colleagues at the Washington Post via social media. And after several days, Jamal Khashoggi grabbed the headlines across the world. The operation that was aimed at eliminating Khashoggi turned into the biggest scandal in Saudi history. But the point is that Saudi Arabia and Turkey have their stories connected to one another in a strange place, in Istanbul, or the ancient city of Constantinople, the capital city of the Ottoman Empire, which goes back to 100 years ago when the First World War ended, the Ottoman Empire collapsed and Saudi Arabia was born. Geographical maps have not remained unchanged. Today's borderlines between nations and regions have seen constant changes over the centuries. Some people have come, put a pen on the map, and changed the lines as they wished and thought it was better, placing people on each side of the borderlines, and stories after stories have unfolded. This is Sarajevo, a city whose strange events at the beginning of the 20th century decided the world's fate several decades later. Sarajevo is located in Bosnia that was annexed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire several years before the war. But the neighboring Serbia was opposed to the move because it was seeking to expand the Balkan region through uniting Slavs, and from 1914 onwards was creating unrest and insecurity in different Bosnian cities. The long-awaited day was June the 28th, 1914, when Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austro-Hungary, was in Sarajevo on an official visit. Ferdinand and his wife were leaving Sarajevo's municipality when they were assassinated by 19-year-old Bosnian nationalist Gavrilo Princip. The young man had been armed by the Serbs. On July the 23rd, the Austro-Hungarian government demanded an investigation into the assassination, which was rejected by Serbia. In less than 3 months, the assassination made that time's big European powers engage in a brutal and complicated conflict. The Allies believed that the battlefield should be changed somewhere behind the enemy front, where it could be stabbed in the back. One of these plans on the map was to gain access to Ottoman borders from behind. The Ottoman Empire had become a strong ally of Germany months after the start of the war and had turned into an effective force on the front line. Shortly after the start of the war in November of 1914, and after the Ottoman Empire officially joined the war, its caliph, in the middle of regular demonstrations in Constantinople, declared war on Britain. While Ottoman troops were preparing to fight the Allies, Saudi deserts were chosen as the venue to infiltrate the Ottoman borders. Assistant of British Secretary of War, Herbert Kitchener, informed him that a person proper to accept ruling Muslims had already made contact. That person was the ruler of Mecca, whose name was Hussein ibn Ali. In 1908, Ottoman King Abdul Hamid II appointed Hussein ibn Ali as the Sharif of Mecca and ruler of Hejaz. The title of Sharif was given to an individual who was descended from Prophet Muhammad, and Sharif Hussein was from Hashim clan. After Sultan Abdul Hamid II was deposed by the Committee of Unity and Progress, a silent war gradually broke out between Sharif Hussein and the Young Turks as he was attempting to gain more independence in Hejaz. Sharif Hussein was playing with both sides of the battle, the Ottomans and the British, to buy time and find a solution in future. At the same time, he was also consulting with his tough rival in eastern Saudi Arabia, Abdul Aziz bin Saud. In January 1915, British Secretary of War Herbert Kitchener, after getting approval from the Foreign Office and to attract Arab-speaking people, took even another step and ordered the British agency in Cairo to issue a declaration stating that Britain would not only help Saudi Arabians, but also all Arab speakers in Asia, from Palestine and Syria to Mesopotamia, gain independence. Britain is also making attempts to attack the Ottomans elsewhere at the Dardanelles. If fighting is successful there, it will lead to the conquest of Constantinople and will create a significant divide between the Ottoman and German fronts. The conquest of Constantinople could also lead to the total collapse of the Ottoman Empire. On March 15, 1915, the British and French joint navy entered the scene. But Turkish forces deployed at the mouth of Dardanelles and armed with heavy artillery and underwater minefields prevented them from entering the strait. They sank 3 warships and caused heavy damage to 7 others. 10 out of 18 warships that had entered were removed from the battlefield due to serious damage. Winston Churchill, the architect of the operation, was forced to step down after the defeat. However, a month later, British military officials made a new attempt to deploy forces off the Turkish coast of Gallipoli. They had decided to seize the Ottoman artillery to make up for their defeat at the Dardanelles. This battle shortly turned into a war of attrition as well. The jubilation of the Allies in the early days of the battle turned into a historic regret. 500,000 people from each side had come to the arena, half of whom never returned home. The war that took Britain a step closer to the conquest of the Middle East ended up in a bitter defeat. All these events made Hejaz, which was a remote place in the scorching dry deserts of Saudi Arabia, gain more and more importance. Saudi Arabia was far from the center of Ottoman power, known as Bab al-Ali in Constantinople, and there were very few connecting roads, and the rulers there had already collaborated with the British front. In July 1915, ruler of Mecca, Sharif Hussein, wrote a letter to British High Commissioner in Cairo, Sir Henry McMahon. In that letter, Sharif Hussein announced his readiness to cooperate with Britain against the Ottoman rule only if Britain supported the independence of the Hashemite Kingdom, a monarchy that ruled over the entire Arabian Peninsula, Mesopotamia, and the Levant. Sharif Hussein was after all the Arabian regions, from the Persian Gulf coast to the Mediterranean coast, which was something London was not willing to accept. Sharif Hussein had a serious rival in Saudi Arabia, who was Abdul Aziz bin Saud. Britain was negotiating with several different clients for the Arab lands. When the British Secretary of War was pulling out his remaining troops of the Dardanelles, one of his assistants, Sir Mark Sykes, returned to London from a long trip to the Middle East. He came on the scene by submitting a plan to Kitchener to launch a revolution in the Middle East in order to change course in the battle against the Ottomans. Sir Mark Sykes was an experienced journalist on Ottoman affairs and a British embassy officer in Constantinople for 4 years. Therefore, Britain began a complicated game to win the hearts of the Arabs without giving them a clear and unequivocal commitment so that they would not act in favor of the Ottomans and until the fate of the Arab regions is decided following the war. France was another client of the Arab lands. France, since the Crusades, had claims on Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, and now it should be consulted about these regions because it had sent 8 million troops to the battlefield during the First World War and was seriously involved on the Western Front. Therefore, it was important for Britain to consider France's share in the future of the post-war Middle East. For this reason, the British Foreign Office asked the French government to send an envoy to London for negotiations on the future borders of Syria. French envoy François-Georges Picot went to London. At that time, Georges Picot served as the French consul general in Beirut and was aware of France's covetousness in the Arab regions of Syria and Lebanon. Picot was a staunch member of the colonialist faction, and therefore the French government could not find anyone better than him to enter this difficult mission to take France's share from Britain. Negotiations began on November the 23rd, 1915. The negotiations on the future of the Middle East were completely confidential and held only between France and Britain without the presence of other parties. A review of reports from that meeting shows that although France and Britain were apparently on the same front, they clashed over every single part of the Arabian regions. The de Bunsen Committee believed that Britain should divide the regions in a way that those under French rule would stretch from the Mediterranean coasts of Syria and Lebanon to Mosul Governorate. Britain was even ready to relinquish Mosul despite its vast oil reserves, but use France to protect itself against Russia. The presence of France would prevent Russia's infiltration into southern regions. At the end of the day, both Sykes and Picot achieved what they wanted without seeking views of the millions of people living in those regions. The map of the Arabian regions was put on the table, and French and British envoys began drawing the border lines in the absence of representatives of the residents of those regions. All these events happened while Arab groups such as Sharif Hussein and Ibn Saud were engaged in battles with the Ottomans in the hope that they would gain independence following promises by these governments. The border lines on the map were once again being altered, bringing changes to the lives of millions of people in the Arabian regions. Finally, and after a series of meetings, it was agreed that France rules the Great Lebanon and the rest of Syrian soil is put under its exclusive influence, and these regions extend as far as Mosul. Britain got Basra and Baghdad, both of them Mesopotamian regions. Britain also took the ports of Akkar and Haifa in Palestine so that it can build a railroad from the Mediterranean to Mesopotamia. The rest of the region was put under the supervision of a kind of international management. The remaining parts of the Middle East would form an Arabian government or a coalition of governments, which was nominally independent but was practically under the influence of Britain and France. The Sykes-Picot Treaty was approved by France and Britain in early February 1916, but it was kept confidential until 2 years later, when the fate of the war was settled. The treaty later became known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement, only after the two countries agreed on the border lines and made their own gains from their negotiations. Sharif Hussein began an uprising to capture Arab lands on June the 16th, 1916. The uprising had Britain's all-out support. But it had little success and was halted by Ottoman airstrikes in a short period of time. According to the Arab Bulletin published by the British Foreign Office's headquarters in Cairo, the uprising by Sharif Hussein practically failed a year after it began, costing Britain £11 million. London now expected Sharif Hussein's forces to only support themselves. those days, Egypt was under control of Britain. The country previously was part of the Ottoman Empire, but shortly after the Committee of Union and Progress joined the German front, the Egyptian king extended his hand of friendship to London. By order of the British Foreign Office, a central bureau called the Arabian Administration was opened in Cairo, which focused on the Arabian regions of the Middle East. The British Foreign Office began recruiting staff for the newly established bureau, which was headed by David George Hogarth, an intelligence officer who had studied archaeology at Oxford University. He brought to Cairo a young man called Thomas Edward Lawrence, who had worked with him at the Ashmolean Museum of Oxford University. The young man was later known as the Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence, who was 28 years old, had been exempted from military service because he was slightly built. He had previously been employed as a second lieutenant and translator in the geography department of the Ministry of War and had been dispatched to the Middle East on a cartography mission.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Official statistics show that the number of homeless people in London, England, has increased significantly due to increase in the cost of living. According to official statistics, the number of people living on the streets of London has increased by 24%. Britain's economy has faced many challenges in recent years. The exit of Britain from the European Union and the expenses caused by the control of the coronavirus pandemic and government incompetence have all contributed to the current economic crisis. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Metro website has covered this story and tells us more. According to new data, homelessness rate in London was higher than the national rate for England in 2022. Shelter says 1 in 58 people in London were sleeping rough last year, with London's borough councils describing the figures as devastating. The charity Shelter said it is expecting a sharp rise in homelessness in 2023, while local authorities call on the government to ensure changes are made amid the cost of living crisis. Shelter's chief executive, Polly Neat, said, "The new year should be a time of hope, but this isn't the case for the 271,000 homeless people who are facing a truly bleak 2023. Polly Neat added, "A cold doorway or a grotty hostel room is not a home, but this is a reality for too many people today. Our frontline advisors are working to help people who are desperate to escape homelessness, from the parents doing all they can to provide some shred of a normal family life while stuck in an emergency bed and breakfast, to person terrified of another night sleeping rough. Polyneet said, with private rents and living costs continuing to soar, thousands of people are not just facing a winter of worry, they're at risk of losing the roof over their head. Polyneet added, at Shelter, we are bracing ourselves for a sharp rise in homelessness in 2023. More than ever, we'll be relying on the public's generosity to help us support and campaign for all those fighting for a safe home. Figures from the charity show that the rate of homelessness in London last year was nearly three times higher than England as a whole, which saw one in 208 on the streets. Councillor Darren Rodwell, London Council's executive member for Regeneration, Housing and Planning, said these devastating figures reveal that London remains the epicentre of the homelessness crisis in Britain. Darren Rodwell added, everyone deserves a permanent home, but the chronic shortage of affordable housing in the capital means too many Londoners find themselves homeless and reliant on temporary accommodation arranged by their local council. The numbers are so high that they're equivalent to the entire population of a London borough. The website of Inside Housing has also covered the same story. According to new research by Shelter, one in 100 children in England are homeless and living in temporary accommodation. Shelter's analysis found that 26% of the parents of the 120,710 children reported their children are unhappy or depressed as a result of living in temporary accommodation, while many are forced to share beds. Shelter expects the number of homeless children to grow as the cost of living crisis deepens the housing emergency. Recently, Inside Housing's research revealed that more than 26,000 children under the age of 5 are homeless and living in temporary accommodation in England. Temporary accommodation, which can take the form of emergency hostels, bed and breakfast, one-room bedsits and cramped flats, is provided by councils to eligible families who become homeless. It is not designed as permanent accommodation, and families can be asked to move numerous times on short notice. The latest government data shows that 5,030 families are living in emergency bed and breakfast and hostel rooms, widely considered the worst type of temporary accommodation. Shelter study, the largest ever conducted and funded by Trust for London and the Joseph Rantree Foundation, involved more than 800 families with 1,600 children living in temporary accommodation throughout England. It looked at the impact of temporary accommodation on children's health, on children's well-being and education. It found that more than a third, or 35%, of homeless parents say their child or their children do not have a bed of their own and must share with another family member. Almost half, or 45%, of school-age children have arrived at school tired, late or hungry as a result of living in temporary accommodation. Bed and breakfast and hostels are often not equipped with suitable or any facilities for parents to cook meals, and noise from other residents and bed sharing mean children often struggle to sleep. Parents reported that just over 60% of children lack space to play in their temporary accommodation. One in four parents, or about 28%, said their children are finding it hard to make or keep friends as a result of living in temporary accommodation. This can be because they're embarrassed or ashamed of where they live, because they're unable to have friends over to play due to a lack of space or rules that forbid visitors. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A Scottish charity has raised the alarm about the potential of a notable rise in the death rate among the homeless in Scotland, as the entire United Kingdom grapples with a worsening economic crisis. The Simon Community Charity issued the warning as Scotland is still reeling from hundreds of homeless deaths that were registered last year. The network reported recent official figures from the National Records of Scotland reveal an estimated 250 homeless people died last year, which is around 50% higher than in 2017. Lorraine McGrath, the charity's chief executive, said it is a worsening position over the last 3 to 4 years, which is a massive concern. Lorraine McGrath added, the vast majority of these people are under the age of 45, adding, that is because of the massive health inequalities they face and the stress on their body that leads to premature aging, that in turn leads to long-term conditions that may well be easily treatable. Lorraine McGrath added, people experiencing homelessness don't enjoy the same access to healthcare, which increases their risk of early death. Britain's year-on-year inflation rate stands at 10.7%, the highest in 4 decades. Meanwhile, the inflationary spiral is growing at a much faster pace than the average wage rise across the country. Food prices have skyrocketed almost 20%. Rising energy prices, along with soaring energy costs, have also largely contributed to Britain's cost of living crisis. Many labour unions have launched industrial action to press the government to enact wage hikes. The government, however, refuses to increase the wages, saying it would increase inflation. The government blames the economic doldrums partly on the COVID-19 pandemic, saying the country had been having a hard time recovering from the stagnation that used to govern the period. Experts, however, fault leadership incompetence and turbulence that saw the country changing several prime ministers over the past 2 years.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm your host, Zainab. And today in our studio, we have with us our special guest, Professor Salman Nakavi. Assalamu alaikum, Professor.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dear listeners, Professor Nakavi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University and a research scholar over here in the Hawza Almi of Qom. And we have been discussing a series of, we went through a series of episodes with Professor Nakavi where we discussed the levels of tarbiyah and most important topics of tarbiyah Islamic upbringing with him. And today we are continuing some important topic with him. Professor, today I would want to discuss with you the expectations part, because expectations are something that both parents have from the children and also children have from their parents. Now, let's first talk about the expectations of parents that they have from the children, and which ones are the right ones?
So, expectations should be, again, defined. As you said, the right expectations and the wrong expectations. the framework which we should be giving to the expectations which we have from our children should be defined within the framework of the Islamic principles of life, of pure life, of Hayat Tayyiba. So this is what we should be expecting from our children, that they should be able to live a pure life in this world. So we should be expecting them to be to learn things which are important for them in their lives, learning and changing their behavior in a way, in a fashion which would be facilitating this life.
Yeah.
So all the good etiquettes and manners should be taught to them, and we should expect them to behave according to that. And again, we should feel that we want them to behave properly, not because it is our desire. Yes, we desire so, but our desire is whatever Allah desires is our desire. This is important for us, that okay. We should manage our expectations from our children within the realms of Islamic principles. And we should observe the fact that whatever Allah desires of our children, we should also desire the same thing. Now, what does Allah want from us? That is very clear. That is very obvious. That He wants us to be good human beings. He wants us to behave properly in different relations and different situations. Doing what is haram should be refrained from. Doing something which is wajib should be done. Mustahabbat should be carried out. Treating and behaving with others, with neighbors, with friends, with family members, it should be done in a proper way, with respect, with honor, dignity. So these are basically what we want our children to learn. We should provide them good schooling, we should provide them good professional training to be able to be good, have a good professional life. That is all important. But as we said, we have relations with our different types of relations with Allah Almighty, with ourselves, with other human beings, with the environment. We should become good citizens of society. We should become good citizens of our country, and good human beings in the community of nations. In this, the human civilization should become better because of us.
Yeah.
So this is what we expect. I think human beings
should be expecting from the children.
Everything which leads to the dignity of mankind, everything which leads to a dignified living for our children in the future, a good future, should be what we expect from them. And
you are saying that this kind of expectation is a perfect expectation you can have from your children. So, if we summarize it, so the perfect kind of expectations parents can have from the children is that wherever, whatever leads them towards dignity, that should be taken care of, and whatever leads them towards a good living, a dignified living, and also you said proximity towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That is the basic, ultimate thing, is the proximity to Allah Almighty, yeah. Becoming godly, becoming divine, becoming
more spiritual.
Spiritual, yeah. Being close to Allah Almighty.
Yes. We'll discuss more on this topic with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said that we should be, as parents, we should not be expecting much from our children. What is the perfect expect? But this in itself does not mean that we should not be expecting at all. The perfect expectation that a parent can have is the dignified living of a child and something that takes him towards the proximity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, Professor, where do you think parents go wrong? They expect things that are not authorized in Islam.
Yes, we normally we don't have this framework in our minds. We are not. We consider the fact that our children should be Muslims, And how should they be good Muslims? They should pray on time. They should recite the Holy Quran. They should eat halal food, and that's all. This is enough to be a Muslim. They should respect their parents and their friends. That's all. That's being a good Muslim. No, being a good Muslim is much more than that. A Muslim has a mission in life to carry out. A Muslim is responsible for not himself, not only himself, his family. He should be a responsible member of the society. He should play a constructive role in society. So yes, every human being should feel that, understand that we have a mission in life to carry out. Our parents have the same mission. We also have the same mission. We have to work for the progress of Islam in this world. We want humanity to accept Islam as the source of salvation for the whole of mankind. So everyone has to play a role for that, and everyone has to give sacrifices for that. Everyone has to sacrifice his time and his wealth and property, and even his life for that sake. It's not just this. It wasn't just the duty of the imams to do that. It wasn't just in the time of the early days of Islam where sacrifices had to be given. The mission continues today.
Indeed, it does. So you are trying to say that where parents actually go wrong in expectations is that when they give less, when they actually just teach the reciting of Holy Quran, reciting of prayers, and that's it, while as they lag behind in teaching them humanity, patience, forgiving, and sacrifices, and much more things that Islam has taught us, one or the other way.
So they are basically two. They think we have two parts in life: one being a good Muslim, one being a good bread earner, a person who lives a good life, has a good house, a car, a good living,
good material life.
And being a Muslim just entails to be praying and fasting on time, and that's all. So these two things are, this is the secular opinion about life. This is dividing it into two parts. One is the worldly life, what is good for the world, and one is for the hereafter. We think praying and fasting and reciting the Holy Quran and going for ziyarah, this is going to...
That's all enough.
That's enough for the...
I have enough in my store.
Yeah, that's enough for the hereafter. And for this worldly life, I need to be able to make a good living, have a good house, good a wife and children, a good profession to make my living. And that's something to do with the world. So these are two separate domains.
We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said that I was saying the expectations of parents. Where do they expect good and where do they expect wrong? In the very first part, you said, what is the good kind or what is the best kind of expectation you should be having? That's whatever leads your child to a dignified life and attaining proximity towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that should be actually encouraged, and this kind of expectation is not wrong. Then you said where we expect wrong is that where we are giving less, like we are just counting on our prayers, recitation of Quran and ziyarah is enough, that's all I should be having in store, but then expecting a lot, that's very wrong. And another thing you said, we try to upbring our children in a way that they have a good house, they have a good car tomorrow, they have a good material life, which again you said is not a good expectation.
it's not wrong to have that expectation. I mean, you need to have a good place to live in. You need. It's no, not wrong to have a...
So are you trying to say this this kind of expectation should not be the only expectation you should be focusing upon, or you forget all others while actually giving more emphasis to this?
All these things are means to an end. If you have these things and you forget what the end result should be, what should be the real goal in life, and you just focus on the means. I mean, there's no wrong in saying, when we say, look, we need to be able to be able to move around. We should have a car. So, of course, you have to have a car. You need to move about, or you can use public transport. That's not an issue. You need to be able to move around. You need mobility, you know, that's for sure. But what is the purpose of that? What is the end result of that? Are you doing something which is going to be useful for other human beings? Are you doing something which is beneficial for other human beings? Are you providing services to others? Are you participating in the development of society? Are you participating in the development of the civilization of Islam, which we hold dear to our hearts, that in the future we are aspiring for and praying for a future where Islam will reign supreme according to the Holy Quran. لِيُزْهِرَ وَلَدِّينِ كُلِّهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْكَافِرُونَ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُشْرِكُونَ, where with the advent of Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, we should be expecting a new civilization. Are we preparing ourselves for that? Are we preparing our children for that? Are we preparing to? Are we ready to give sacrifices for that? That is the issue. That has to be taken care of. That has to be understood. That is the major purpose. Yes, for example, if you have a car, you need to maintain that. The body which we live in, which in our spiritual essential existence lives within the body, is attached to the body. The body has to be kept nourished.
All right. Well, what we conclude over here is that our body and our spiritual board should be taken care of. Like you said, having a good car, having a good house, this is all financial security, which should not be diminished at the same time. But what you are saying, that it should not be the only focus, it should not be the only concern. What should be the main concern, that all this takes us towards the proximity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.